Before we get started with today's show, I want to talk about the Right Time Book Club, so everybody's up on that. Every year we do a book club, normally in the summer. This year we moved it up, and the book is The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith. Our first episode with the book club is Thursday, April 23rd. Our first guest on that will be J.A. Adande. Read up through the chapter that is November 1990. That's what we'll be talking to J.A. about this week coming. After that, we'll talk to Vinnie Goodwill of Yahoo Sports. We'll talk to Joe Dumars of the Detroit Pistons. We'll talk to BJ Armstrong of the Chicago Bulls, and we'll wrap it up with Sam Smith, the author of the book. Be sure to check that out. Be sure to check out the Bill Barnwell Show this week as we lead up to and following the NFL draft. Recently, he chatted with draft analyst Todd McShay, and they did a full breakdown of what the teams at the top of the draft look for in a quarterback. Also, we're going to be discussing Jordan and the Bulls' first championship with the Right Time Book Club, but tune into The Last Dance, a behind-the-scenes look at the final championship of the Chicago Bulls dynasty. The series continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. Listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen Jacoby immediately following the broadcast, brought to you by AT&T and State Farm. When you want the real deal, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. It's available wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about the hilarity that should ensue with the virtual NFL draft. We'll also talk to Ethan Strauss about his new book, The Victory Machine, about the Warriors dynasty. But first, The Last Dance is here, and shout out to ESPN. I feel comfortable saying this. Everybody know what's going on. Hey, man, we ain't got no sports to cover. We about to cover ourselves, and I appreciate the fact that we've decided that we are going to cover ourselves. Gabe, we are covering this documentary as though it is the Super Bowl, like it is the NBA Finals itself. Thank you.
Immediately following it, when Scott had that kind of like SportsCenter reaction special, it was literally broken down with highlights and captions and everything.
Yes. And you know why I got no problem mentioning the fact that this is what's happening? Because y'all are here like, yo, I can't wait for Bo to break down, The Last Dance. This is what we got right now. This is what we're on. This is the IG Live sport for the sports folks, right? Like this is what we have. And I found the first two episodes entertaining. I have seen the first 8. I got the plug and went ahead and checked those out. So like I have seen the first 8 of them. What did you think of the first 2, Gabe? I'm curious.
I was quite shocked at how Krause was absolutely torched. Not shocked at the actual principle of it, because the principle of it makes sense, especially given everything that we're reading in the Jordan Rules, which you'll talk about on Thursday with JA, but just that how blatant it was. It had me look up and see, is Krause still alive? He'd passed away in 2017, but I looked up and I was like, damn, we're really doing this to a dead guy who can't defend himself.
Yeah, and as someone made a good point, there are people in the documentary who defend Jerry Krause. The problem is nobody cares about those people, right? So Bill Whittington is like, hey, Jerry's okay with me. Hey, I don't give a damn what Bill Whittington thinks. Impressive mustache, by the way. But like, hey, like they're like, okay, whatever. Yeah, great. You like Jerry Krause. I bet you would, fool. All right. Scotty didn't like him. Mike didn't like him. And I think that the way that Mike interacts with Krause is kind of going to be a defining thing about the way that people feel about Michael Jordan after this is done. Because my thing with him and Krause is I actually didn't find the things that we have on camera, at least, about the way that he talked to Krause to be that cruel. The issue, though, is that he actually doesn't like him. Right? Like, it's not as though the stuff he's saying about Jerry Krause being short and he's saying about Jerry Krause being fat, it's not like that's followed up by putting your arm around him and being like, oh man, but you know, you still my dog. No, actually, you're not my dog. I really don't like you at all. Right? Like that one, when people talk about Mike as bully, I don't feel like the examples of him dealing with his teammates really speak to a bully. Right? Like, I just feel like that's kind of the competitive ecosystem in a lot of ways. And for Mike, every day on a basketball team is a group project. And I guess for everybody else, every day on the basketball team is a group project. The difference is Mike, the smart kid in the group that everybody knows at the end, you're going to be the one that writes this, right? And so you always got these cats that ain't really holding up their end of the bargain in the group project, right? Like you wind up in those situations. And so one thing the documentary gets to a little more, though I didn't think they spelled this out like really clearly, but I remember, Gabe, never forget this in my life. I was in eighth grade and I was in earth science, and every 6 weeks you'd get a new lab partner. Like that would be the person that you sat next to, you know, and all of that stuff. And the first 6 weeks, it really just went by alphabetical order. Then after that, the teacher had a chance to kind of scope out peep game, who's who, who's what, you know, who got what game, who doesn't. And, you know, they tried to teach life lessons based upon who your partner was. And Gabe, that meant I very often got stuck with a mediocre partner, right? Like that was just kind of what the game was. It went until the last 6 weeks that you got to pick your own partner. And I was like, finally, right? I was out there like LeBron looking for D-Wade. Like, okay, let me get somebody else that's on this game. But I remember I had a partner, and look, man, I knew who I was. She knew who I was. And so when it really came down to the heavy lifting, I'll do it, right? She's just going to kind of coast. But at least with two people, it wasn't so bad because it felt like it was an understanding. Like this all made sense. Everybody understood it. But I'll never forget this once, man. Every time, I may have told you the story. People may have heard this tell this story before. But we were entrusted with this project of making, we had two straws, some scissors, some tape, and some aluminum foil. And we were supposed to make a boat, right, that you could put into water, and then we would put like little weights in it, and whoever's boat could hold the most weight would win the contest. Got it. I got to work on that, man, right? This is my time to shine, baby, right? Like it's some application to it. Man, I went through all this thinking. I was coming up with all these shapes. I was coming up with everything else. Man, by the time I got done, my little boat was so tiny. Like it looked like, I'm trying to think of like what the size is on it. I can't even give you an explanation. The weights we were putting in could barely fit on the boat because I had thought it up so much, so many different ways and everything else. You know who won that contest, man? No lie, right? And he seemed like a nice enough dude. I'm certainly not going to say his name. And I'm not saying that he could not read, but like when it came time to read in front of class, whoever was sitting next to him was always the one nudging him and giving him the words, right? Like academics just wasn't his bag. He won that whole thing. And you know what his boat was? He just took that aluminum foil, made a rectangle, and put the straws on the side. That was it. That was it, right? So I just say that to say that every now and then, the other person in the group project could possibly be helpful. That girl that I was just like waving off every play, she probably could have been like, yo, you being stupid right now, cutting this thing into all these little pieces, right? And I know this because the dude over there won the whole damn thing and got to take the trip to the Johnson Space Center and all of that stuff, right? Yeah. I remember that part just dawned on me. There was a prize involved. But anyway, with Mike kind of winds up in that place, like with the way that he is with the Bulls and the way that he treats the team, where at some point, yeah, you the man, dog. You the one that gets this. But maybe if you let them help with the boat, it might, you know, it might work out a little bit better. And Mike is saying, no, it won't. Right? Like that's got a whole premise, right? Mike is just like, nah, man, they not going to help me out with this group project at all. One person that helped Mike greatly in the group project is Jerry Krause. There's no way around it. Like when you go through, and you'll see this in the Jordan rules, I think, and I think you'll notice it also as the documentary goes on. There's all kinds of moves, and the documentary really doesn't cover it that closely, but there are all kinds of moves that Jerry Krause made that Mike did not like. Just about every single one of those moves was correct, right? Like building a champion around Michael Jordan, especially in that day and age, not the easiest thing in the world. No one had ever built around a 6'6 player to build a champion in the way that Jerry Krause did, right? You didn't have a whole lot of evidence of somebody who was capable of that. And in fact, you don't really have anybody build a champion around a 6'6 guy until the Lakers win it in 2009, right? Like this is a really rare occurrence. Jerry Krause is really, really, really good at his job, but Jerry Krause is really bad at his reading the room. That was the thing for him. And he wanted to be accepted so badly. He wanted to be down so badly. He wanted credit so badly. Mike, just talk about how short and fat you are. every single time. Mike talk about the crumbs on your tie because you be eating donuts. So what's the word I'm looking for? Aggressively, that you wind up with crumbs on your shirt. And you keep showing up and Mike keeps all doing it to you because somehow you think that this next time you're going to show up, something going to change. Then you get Scotty, who, I mean, you can go check the track record on Scotty. Scotty needs somebody with him, right? Like, Scotty ain't going to be the number one on this. Scotty needs somebody with him if he's going to do stuff. And so Mike has now empowered Scotty to treat him the way that Mike does. And so you hear about Scotty cussing him out on the bus and stuff like that. That doesn't happen if Mike doesn't set the tone. And so I don't, again, I feel like Mike was saying stuff. It's a trick bag. I feel like Mike was saying stuff to Jerry Krause where on one level you could be like, damn, man, people been picking on him his whole life about that. On the other hand, you could be like, all right, you still letting people get you hurt by talking about how you short and fat when you've been short and fat? You understand what I'm saying? Like, that winds up being the dilemma. But that's where, if you want to call Mike a bully, I think with Krause is where it's ultimately going to fit. I got a lot less sympathy for these grown-ups that are over here.
The money quote, in my opinion, from the whole thing, from episodes 1 and 2, and tell me if this immediately rings a bell in your head as to who said it. Couldn't tolerate him anymore. Didn't respect him.
Yep, that's Scotty talking about Krause.
You can insult somebody. MJ did about Krause, like, oh, you know, he's fat, he's short, he's got crumbs on his shirt, whatever. When you say that you don't respect somebody.
Yes.
That's the worst it can get, in my opinion, because there's no limit to what you can say at that point. There's no road back.
Yep. Let's ask these questions about Scotty, right? Because Scotty is very much so presented in this as a sympathetic figure, right? Let's talk about Scotty here. But Scotty says he did not respect Jerry Krause. What was there for you to not respect about Jerry Krause? Like, I asked that sincerely about him. You are the dude from Central Arkansas, and Jerry Krause is like a discoverer, in a sense, of you. I mean, I'm sure there's somebody else that would have taken Scotty high in the draft. That's part of why the Bulls had to go trade up to get him, right? But I imagine this was not the easiest sell in the world to a lot of people. Krause is the guy that drafted Scottie Pippen, one of the more unique players in the history of the NBA, right? So he's done this. They built the team up around that was able to win those 3 championships, right? What seemed to be Scottie's problem here, 2 things. One, Jerry Krause was trying to trade Scottie Pippen, right? Like, that seemed to be the thing that really got Scottie. Is Scottie trying to get his money, and he comes to find out that Jerry Krause is trying to trade Pippen for, what was the first one? They tried to trade it for Sean Kemp. That was one. And that would have been a strange trade to make, because if you got Kemp and Rodman on the same team, neither of those guys is a center at a time where you needed a center. But, interesting. I could see why one would do that, right? The other one, and I don't think this comes up in the documentary though, is Krause once tried to trade Pippen to acquire Tracy McGrady. Like, to get the pick to take Tracy McGrady. That wouldn't have won them a championship, but that was the long-term play. There's no question about that, right? Like, you're going into the future with Tracy McGrady. Like, that would have worked. Jerry Krause is good at his job, right? Like, witnessing that is a play of a man who is good at his job. But this is the part about reading the room. You can't break up a champion like that. Not after 97, right? Like, I think after 98, you had more of an argument, but you can't break, you just can't do that. Like, to me, we talk about the Warriors, right? The Warriors re-upped on Klay Thompson. The Warriors re-upped on Draymond Green. This is, you know, around the time and after they lost those finals to the Raptors. No. It was time to trade. It was time to break that whole thing up. All those guys are as good as they've ever been. All those guys are going to decline. This is the time to break it up. In a vacuum, right? But in the real world, no, this is not the time to break this thing up. It's not. You can't face people after this. And remember, Krause wanted to break it up after 97. I think this came up in that last episode. He wanted to break up after 97, but Reinsdorf is like, nah, not while we got Mike. Like, as long as we got Mike, we got to try to win a championship, which is correct, because who's trying to put up with Mike? You imagine that? If they had traded Mike for Tracy McGrady, would have never turned into the player he ultimately turned into if they had traded Scottie Pippen for Tracy McGrady. And you know why? You ever hear the stories about Mike dealing with Kwame Brown?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, let me tell you what Mike would have said to Tracy McGrady. I should call you Sleepy. Nope, not even Sleepy Floyd. You Creepy Floyd. My brother has a homeboy who has a beef with Sleepy Floyd because he was a ball player. He and Sleepy Floyd were trying to highlight the same girl, and Sleepy tried to hit her with the, come on now, he ain't even in the league. And so that dude called Sleepy Floyd Creepy Floyd. Creepy. He just stayed called him Creepy. But I could totally imagine that Mike would just be calling Tracy McGrady Creepy all the time if he was there. Like that wouldn't have worked at the time, but I get where Krause is coming from. Now, we talked about the disrespect that Scotty had for Krause. The other level, of course, is the money, right? Like, this is Scotty's issue. Scotty was underpaid, right? Relative to the rest of the league, Scotty was underpaid. And I sat and I listened on the Twitter as everybody was so mad at the Bulls for not renegotiating Scotty's contract. Everybody was so mad at Scotty's agent, saying Scotty's agent gave him bad advice, so forth and so on, all of these things. What are y'all, deaf? Did y'all not watch the damn movie? The damn movie told you exactly what happened. And what happened was Scotty wanted the security. He wanted the security of a long-term deal. And it sounds like he wanted that, and he wanted money up front, right? Like, he wanted to get some bread now to take care of his people, right? Scotty come from a different set of circumstances than I come from, right? Scotty got them 12 brothers and sisters. Scotty went to college and grew 5 or 6 inches after he got there. And people are like, wow, that's amazing. There's nothing amazing about that. It's very easy to know what happened under those circumstances. That man had not been getting 3 square meals a day ever in his life before he got to college. He got a different level of nutrition, and now he grows. This happens in the Army. This happens in college football programs. Like, this is not quite as uncommon as people think. It's a food scarcity issue. It is a nutrition issue, right? That's what Scotty comes from. Scotty comes into the league. He signed a long deal because he wanted the security of the long deal. That deal was up. He wanted the security of a long deal. He signed the long deal, and then he felt underpaid. I feel confident saying this. I don't know Scotty's agent, but when you get a chance, look up Jimmy Sexton. He is the superpower broker among coaches. Like, he's Nick Saban's agent, for example. He's Tim Tebow's agent. He is a magician. Look, I once watched Jimmy Sexton. If Shannon's listening, he knows exactly what I'm about to talk about. North Carolina, the year before Butch Davis got there, won 3 games. Butch Davis's first year, they won 4 games. Arkansas's coaching job came open. Jimmy Sexton got Butch Davis, I want to say, a $200,000 a year raise for turning 3 wins into 4. That's all he had to do was turn 3 wins into 4. I'm just saying, y'all are saying the dude that could turn 3 wins into 4 is the one that gave Scotty bad advice. Here's what it sounds like to me. Bulls and Jimmy are having whatever their negotiation is. They're having their back and forth. I don't know if the Bulls presented something first or if Jimmy presented something first, but it sounds very clearly like Jimmy walked in and was like, this is what Scotty wants. Because people don't get this. Your agent works for you. Like, your agent's job is to get you the best deal he can. But the bottom line is, your agent is kind of like your barber. He's supposed to give you what it is that you want. Like, I got a partner that used to be a barber, and he said a dude came in and asked for a shag, right? Gabe, I don't think you know about the shag, but you go up looking like at the early New Edition pictures. It's the black people mullet. You know what I'm saying? Where it's short on top and then it gets long. Yeah. That's the shag. And so, but this is like the year 2000. And he says the dude's coming in asking for a shag. And he's like, yo, man, I ain't really trying to give you a shag. He's like, yo, but I want a shag. He's like, yo, I'm really not trying to give you a shag. And he was like, all right. And finally he said to him, look, I give you this shag, but you just can't tell nobody like who gave it to you. I just can't have you out in these streets saying I'm out here giving people shags, right? And he said he gave him a very good shag. He was very proud of the shag that he gave him. But in the end, if the man say he want a shag, you got to give him a shag. Scotty walked in and was like, yo, I want a shag. And he's like, yo, I don't really think you want a shag. He's like, yeah, no. I want a shag, right? My mama likes how I look with a shag. I want a shag, right? And so Jimmy Sexton walks into Jerry Reinsdorf and is like, so here's what Scotty wants. And Jerry Reinsdorf looks at it and is like, he wants a shag? Yo, Scotty, you don't want to be out here with a shag right now. He's like, no, I want a shag. All right, man, if you want a shag, boom, there you go. You got a shag. Then next thing you know, Scotty go to school. He look around and see everybody else got fresh haircuts in line with the current style. And now Scotty over here mad because he got a shag. You the one that said you wanted a shag. All right, well, I don't want a shag no more. I want a haircut like them. All right, cool. You're going to have to sit down and get in line. And then after we get through the line, I can figure, I want you to fix my shag right now. But Scotty, you said you wanted a shag. I feel like y'all are disrespecting me. No, man, once you made the decision to get the shag, that's who you are. You the dude with the shag. You got to ride out this shag. And so everybody's argument, well, the Bulls could have renegotiated. They absolutely could have renegotiated. You're right about that. It would have really been a nice thing if the Bulls were to renegotiate. Let me ask y'all a question, man. Who are these nice people y'all be working for? Right? Can you let me know something about that? Because I can relate to Scotty. And here's where I can relate to Scotty. Now, of course, it's different because I never had like the specter of poverty in my life. But this is where I can relate to Scotty. I have been in a situation where I did not have money before. I've been in a situation where somebody offered me a contract and I have been there and I look back at them and I say, yeah, I want that contract to be 1 year longer. And they look at me and they're like, I mean, are you sure? Like, we normally don't do that. And, you know, I'm like, nah, I want the extra year. And they're like, all right, take the extra year if you want it. Now, it all worked out well for me, but I remember something my agent told me when I signed that deal. He was like, look, man, by the end of this contract, you are going to be underpaid. Like, just so you know this, by the time you get to the back end of this, you're going to be underpaid and you need to like deal with that fact up front. And Scotty didn't deal with that fact up front, right? TV deals exploded. Like, Gabe, have you ever heard of a gentleman named John Hot Rod Williams?
The name sounds familiar.
Okay, let me tell you the best part of John Hot Rod Williams' Wikipedia page, and I'm going to look it up now to make sure that it's in it. But I know if it's not in his Wikipedia page, it needs to be in his Wikipedia page. John Hot Rod Williams was once the highest paid player in the NBA. Dead serious. Dead serious. After the 1990 season, he signed a 7-year, $26.5 million contract, and it said it made him one of the highest paid, five highest paid players, they say, in the early 1990s. And he wasn't even a starter, Gabe. He wasn't even a starter. What happened was the game changed on the TV money. And once the game changed on the TV money, now they had more money to spend on guys, and a guy like Hot Rod Williams would come in and get a $3.5 million contract, which is something that could not happen before. Scotty signed his deal in 1991, right? Like, he signed according to that. He wanted a long deal, like Hot Rod Williams. Hot Rod Williams is like, yo, it ain't never going to be this good for me again. Let me get the 7-year deal. Scotty signed that long deal, and at the end, it just didn't look the way that it did at the beginning. It just didn't.
It's kind of like, who's the top paid quarterback in the league?
Yes.
It's the next quarterback. That's who it is.
Yes. And the issue with the NBA is, since the money is guaranteed, you're not really doing no whole lot of holding out. Like, if Scotty really wanted to make that happen, he needed to hold out, right? Like, I don't know what the rules were at the time for a basketball player on that front, but like, if he really wanted to make that happen, then what you need to do is to hold out and to make them give you that bread. Otherwise, I'm sorry, I don't blame the Bulls for being like, hey, we took care of you on the front end of this deal, right? So what you want us to do is give you all the benefits of a short deal and all the benefits of a long deal. And if they say that's not the way they're going to do business, that's fine. Like, one thing you're going to learn later in the doc, and I hate to be like, the be fair to Jerry Reinsdorf, Reinsdorf was getting a discount on Mike, right? Everybody knows. He was getting a huge discount on Mike. But when Mike played baseball, they didn't pay him a double-A salary. They paid him the NBA salary, right? Part of that is Reinsdorf said because Michael had been underpaid. The other part, I would assume, is because Reinsdorf really wanted Michael Jordan to play NBA basketball again, and it was absolutely worth the money just to, like, keep that going, you know, to get Mike to come back. It was worth it. Now, with the Bulls, this is the other part I think that gets lost. If they thought that the best days of Scottie Pippen were ahead of them, then they would have worked it out.
Reinsdorf had said both to MJ and to Scotty that, why do you want to sign this? You shouldn't sign this, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're going to be underpaid, right? Mm-hmm. Reinsdorf's point of view, if you can sign somebody to a long-term agreement that they're going to be underpaid towards the end of it, great. It's good business for you, right? Because you have a top NBA player, not at the highest possible salary point he could be at. So you have more cap flexibility, whatever, yada, yada, yada. But I wanted to ask you, and you're getting to there, do you think that he was trying to match up Pippen's time with the Bulls as the same to Mike's time with the Bulls? Because if you think that Pippen is your next piece to build around, you renegotiate that while it's still going on and maybe get him a more fair number so that you can tack on the extra years. Because a lot of times it's like, okay, you know, I signed this long-term agreement, five-year deal, whatever. After 2 years, it's not such a fair deal anymore. But this is a really, really important piece to me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to renegotiate it for a higher number, but I'm also going to tack on like 3 or 4 more years to it so that I have this asset under control for longer. But if you don't do that, what you risk doing is you risk alienating the talent to the point where when they see, cool, you don't want to renegotiate with me? All right.
Yep.
Well, I'm just going to run my deal down. And when it's done, I'm out.
Yep. Here's the thing, man. Scotty was finished after 98. I don't think Scotty ever made an all-star team again after 98. He was never a true number one option on a team after 98. If Krause's thing was Pippen's going to be finished 97, 98, he was right. Right? Like the end of Scottie Pippen's career as a star player was Game 6 of the 98 NBA Finals. And by the way, if Mike doesn't hit that shot in Game 6 against Utah, they lose that series. There's no way Scottie was going to be able to play with his back hurting the way it was. And keep in mind that Scottie had to have that surgery to start that season. That's the whole running theme in this, that Scottie had to have that. Like, I get why people are like, damn, y'all were mean to Scottie. But I also look at Krause and I'm like, nope, you called this right. Right? Like, just about every turn on this, if he had made the trade of Pippen for Tracy McGrady and Jordan didn't ruin Tracy McGrady, we would talk about the genius of Jerry Krause for making that trade. Except, Jerry Krause can't read a room. It just wasn't going to work. But I don't feel bad for Scotty. I don't look at Scotty in that deal. Also, it wasn't like Scotty was getting paid $75,000 a year. He made a trade-off on that deal. But that's why you got to read the room. And he just couldn't get. It don't matter how much sense this makes. This is not the play. I also think like the whole idea of Krause just saying, okay, no more Phil. That's the dumb play to me, right? If you wanted to tear it down around the talent, I get that. But the 94 season should have been enough to tell you that Phil can do this even if you don't have Michael Jordan.
When you talk about reading the room and being like good at your job, people think of Bob Myers as being good at his job, right? Mm-hmm. Bob Myers is cool with Lacob, but then he's also cool with Kerr. And Bob Myers is then also cool with Steph Curry. And he's also cool with KD. As bad as things got, he was still cool with KD. Whereas Krause, to your point about the group project earlier, right? MJ felt like he was carrying the team. He felt like he was carrying the rest of his group. But in terms of a group project that's one-on-one with two people, your point about reading the room, you got to be able to read the room with that one other person.
Right.
So say Krause is good at his job, like on a day-to-day standpoint in terms of making trades. He's not good at his job if he can't get along with Phil.
Well, I mean, he's good at it if you can win 6 championships, right? Because you're right. That's a giant flaw in his ability to do the job, is his inability there to read the room. Like, where he gets lucky is that Michael Jordan is such a sociopath that you couldn't make him angry enough at Jerry Krause that he was not going to go out here and try to win it, right? But the difference is Jerry Krause is a scout. Bob Myers is an agent. Like, Jerry Krause is strictly bottom line oriented, where Myers' whole game is moving in rooms.
When they quoted Krause as saying, I don't care if you go undefeated about Phil.
Yeah.
You're not coming back. They didn't quite get into it other than like who got the credit. Mm-hmm. But what happened with Krause and Phil? Why couldn't it continue? Why did they see the end of MJ and Scotty and the end of that dynasty, so to speak? Why did it have to be the end of Phil?
No, I agree with you there. Like, that's the one I don't get, is that like, and I didn't get a great handle on like the relationship breaking down. I didn't feel like any of that happened. Cause look, this is a legitimate criticism, I think, to be had of the documentary, at least for these first 2 episodes. I didn't feel what the situation was, right? Like, and you know, it's just reading the Jordan rules. When the Jordan rules, you got a feel for what it was like on those early Bulls teams that Mike was on, right? Like, I don't get a feel for how miserable that situation was to be on that team. Now, I got a feeling about what Game 2 in 86 was against the Celtics. Like, I felt that, right? But I didn't get a feel for that. And I don't feel like I got a feel for why it was that Phil had to go. Like, why that thing had to break down the way that it ultimately did. But no, that's where Krause was wrong. But with Pippen, all of that to me is just the cost of doing business, baby. And I don't blame, like, even Scotty sitting down there will tell you, I wanted the security. But then he was feeling disrespect. You go get a lot of double talk from Scotty, by the way, in the places where he may not have gone right. You're going to be like, but you just said. It's a lot of that. It's a lot of that with Scotty. But nah, man, he ultimately made $100-something million in the NBA. It worked out. His people were taken care of. Do not weep for Scotty.
Now, you talk about the game against the Celtics. A lot of people are pulling out the LL Cool J, I'm Bad sequence. Mm-hmm. What did you think of the music selection?
Okay, so keeping in mind, I've seen a lot of it. That one is another example. They use I Ain't No Joke very well earlier.
When they played that, I was like, all right, let's go.
No, the music supervision is really interestingly done in that I thought they picked good songs, but none of them are like right on the nose. There's a little syncopation, right? There's a little swing in their choices on the music, right? Like, it's kind of like if you bowling, you can't roll it straight down and hit the head pin, right? You need it just a little to the side to make all of them fall. And they did a good job of getting just to the side. My one thing about I'm Bad, though, was they needed to step the tempo up, right? Because it's like, it's such an energetic song and it gets you. And I mean, I love that, but it needed to go a little faster because Mike is attacking in a way that LL is not. Not that LL isn't attacking, but LL ain't attacking at that pace that Mike is attacking at. Me and Shannon, the day that me and Shannon realized we was going to work together forever, we would do a radio on Saturday morning once, and he played I'm Bad as a bump, and we just played the whole first verse. We just jumped around the studio. I was back all, I couldn't breathe.
Well, do you think, you talk about the tempo of that song. Do you think that they used that song because it had a little bit of a slower tempo so they could take that one game and play it out into a full sequence where it's like, all right, we've got all these interviews with Larry Bird, other people. Yeah. Like, we don't want it to go too fast because we want to draw out this moment.
Well, I guess it also then allows you to focus on Mike a little more, right? Like, to focus on this, because this is what I asked you as a person who did not grow up with this, right? Like, I don't remember that game happening as it happened, but I've always been aware of it. Do y'all get it now? Right? Like, do y'all realize there's only been one of these?
Yeah. Yeah. After watching those highlight sequences, you know, I was thinking, where can I watch this full game? I got to go back and watch these full games. You get a sense from watching the highlights, but like when you watch the full game and you get the feeling, I wanted to talk to somebody who was inside the arena that day.
Mike is the coldest that they've thrown out here. Like, what you watching that is just like, yo, he's cold. He is so cold. And we have four more weeks to discuss.
Yes, we do. To put an end on this discussion, why right now? I never got a handle on why this documentary came out right now. Like, I mean, the fact that they have all the footage and the fact that everyone signed off on this is just absolutely incredible. But why April 2020? I mean, I understand why April, but
right,
it was supposed to come out later this year. Why 2020?
Well, he signed off on it, I want to say around 2016, somewhere in there. And my understanding is Mike knows y'all don't know, right? Like, this is an introduction of Michael Jordan to the world, right? To a world that knows him as a meme. And take notes, kids. Take notes. All right, NFL draft, Thursday night. They did a mock draft and they tried to get everything rolling with the technology. Some people say it went smooth. Some people saying it was a little bit rocky. In the midst of this recording, we had the connection drop out once. Can you imagine the panic of the connection dropping out? Like, I actually think people are being too hard on these NFL folks right now. And people are like, damn, NFL can't even figure out how to have a Zoom meeting. Guys, the stakes are a little higher for the NFL in their meeting. If somebody drops out, it means something just a little bit different. And people have been breaking into these Zooms, wilding out. This is an ambitious undertaking that we are talking about here. When everything is rolling right and rolling smooth, there's a chance that something can go wrong when these sorts of things happen. Like, I get why everybody associated with the draft right now has just got to be like, yo, this is so strange. What's it going to be? Like, are you ready for disaster? Like, I'm not going to clown these folks if it goes bad. I just can't.
I'd be interested to know exactly what platform they're using. Like, if they plan on using Zoom. Because to your point about it getting hacked, right? I've read all these articles and from our guy, Drew Harwell. He does a bunch of stuff for, if you haven't heard, he's been sharing a bunch of stories about Zoom getting hacked and how easy it is for Zoom to get hacked. I mean, my wife has been doing her classes on Zoom. Right. And they use the same link every week and it got hacked. And there was like a weird dude with like a smog mask and some other dude with just like a dog as his like screen crashing Phil 101.
Right.
And the kids were panicking. Right. They're like, what the hell is this? So they had to switch over to like a more secure network. But it's not like the NFL has their own secure video chat unless they created one. That stuff takes time. Is that information going to get out and are people going to hack it?
Well, I find that the higher the stakes, the less likely the entity is to use Zoom. That's something I'm noticing as I'm doing different things now in this time with all, you know, this different stuff, that when it's kind of a do-it-yourself job, people are getting on Zoom. Like that real money is not on Zoom. They have, someone has made a decision that their IT man is like, this is not what we going to do. But like, these are the things they have to figure out. And again, one thing I saw them mention and I thought was perfectly legitimate, that for the coaches, they're like, yo, the problem is I can't have the IT man in my house. Right? Like, we need to get this set up as best as we can. They're going to be going through a lot of data, a lot of files, a lot of names, a lot of people from a lot of locations, a lot of moving parts, like all of this. I have a measure of sympathy for all those people who are engaging in this. And I think it's too easy to be a relatively young person. Old people don't know how to use the technology. Man, we have problems with the technology. You know what I'm saying? Like all of these things are going to happen. They're going to go on, but they are going to be funny if they like come about in like the worst ways. I will admit, I will get a chuckle here and there as these things go on. Also, think about this. What if you actually come to find out that this is the thing that winds up exposing Bill Belichick? He's out here talking about the snapbook and the Instaface. It's hard for me to believe that Bill Belichick ain't all over these computers. It's hard. Too much access to too much information. It's too much up his alley.
Who's going to screw up first? Which team?
Oh, the Texans. I mean, the answer is always Bill O'Brien. Bill O'Brien probably fired the damn IT man because he didn't like him. You know what I'm saying? Like, he probably that guy. Who the coach that actually got his wife doing all the stuff on the computer because he don't do that, right? Like, if this had Nick Saban involved, Miss Terry would be over there getting this stuff cracking. Who gonna be the one? I mean, there is just so much that is going to be going on here. So much.
If the wife is the one who's making things happen, is she also on headset?
Good question. I'm going to need another one, guys. Can I get a headset for a smaller head, please?
Oh, my gosh.
Can we do this? Like, we ain't even all that going on. We ain't even have a chance to talk about no players.
We will have time for you to talk about that next week.
All the time in the world to talk about everything. Assuming we don't talk about Jordan for 30 more minutes, which we will. Trust me, we will. All right, we have got a guest joining us right now. Check out his book, The Victory Machine. It's a look at the Golden State Warriors dynasty of just, well, I guess last year. That's when it was. He also writes for The Athletic. His name is Ethan Strauss. Sir, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Bo.
So how's this go, try to sell a book while the world is ending?
You know, it's funny. The world ending, not so funny. But me trying to sell a book while the world is ending, a little bit funny. I really don't have anything to compare it to, as far as I know. This is the only way it's done. So it's weird. It's a lot of phone calls. I just accidentally appeared on television today because I didn't know any better. I appeared on that Fox First Things First. I figured they wanted, I don't know, a phoner or something at 4 a.m. And I went out to my car. It was pitch black outside. I went out to my car and the producer was like, no, this is how we do things. Like, you're getting on Skype. We're all on Skype. You're going to be on national television. You got to get back in the living room. So yeah, it's very ad hoc is what I would say for myself and for everybody else.
Well, what I feel like you reminded everybody of, in case they had forgotten, is, man, we really like stories about Kevin Durant, right? Right. And this is, but I think it's interesting because, you know, the book is really about the whole run and about how achieving a championship is not necessarily the path to happiness. And Durant was not there for the whole run, but it is interesting how he shows up in the middle of it, but becomes the clearest example of what seems to be the thesis that you're putting forth in the book.
Yeah, or at least the thesis that's easiest to write about, because the thing with great basketball, you don't need a whole lot of context to understand it. Maybe that was my job for a while, of saying, oh, the Warriors played great. Oh man, they played so great. Everybody's so happy. That's pretty cool. Oh, here's some cool stats on how many deep threes Steph Curry hits. But for the most part, that's just something that we instantly get. Like in The Last Dance, when they're doing the 2-minute montage of Michael Jordan against the Boston Celtics, we can just watch that and enjoy it. The part that we need some literary context for, or at least we like to talk about in the aftermath, it's what happens when the dynasty falls apart, because that's when you get into the Greek tragedy stuff. That's when you get to, why is the ego undermining this great thing that everybody should be enjoying in theory? And that just keeps happening in the NBA again and again. And Kevin Durant was at the center of it.
It seems to me that Kevin Durant, and I can see how he reached this conclusion, he was like, look, man, I'm going to go to the Warriors. I'm going to win a championship. I'm going to win it over LeBron. quid pro quo, I am the best basketball player in the world, and everybody will say that I am the best basketball player in the world. He did those things, and we were like, oh, good job, Kev. Way to go. Still number two.
That's exactly what happened, and it was almost like how these companies have a formula, or they have something that's working, where we do content like this, and this has gotten ratings, so you do content like that, and it will get ratings. It was a very formulaic application, and you could see it from his perspective. You have to remember, he was on that Thunder team in 2012 that lost the finals to LeBron James's super team, and that redeemed LeBron in the aftermath of LeBron winning that finals over the Thunder in 2012. A finals, by the way, in which Kevin Durant scored over 30 points a game, shooting on crazy efficiency. Nobody cared. We all reacted and said, LeBron James, you are now the best player. You are a made man. You have won a championship. Congratulations. A lot of us who are mad at you are no longer mad at you. So Kevin Durant gets his own super team, crushes LeBron James in the finals, and I think would expect that we would all respond by saying, you are now the number one player. You're a made man. You've got your ring. But human beings just aren't predictable like that. Or, Bomani, you and I can understand why the rule did not apply to Kevin and why 73 wins is different from whatever the Miami Heat were. But in his mind, and you could see it, it just wouldn't have worked out that way.
The irony, though, is that it's Steph Curry's fault, right? and this is why I say it's Steph Curry's fault. It's that 73-win season, 2016, where Steph Curry had quite possibly the greatest offensive season that any player has ever had in the NBA. And a lot of us were like, are we really about to say this 6'3 dude's the best player in the NBA? But he kept presenting all this evidence that led us to finally be like, all right, man, I feel like I kind of got to say it, even if I don't mean it, that Steph Curry's the best player in the NBA. And then LeBron was like, word, oh, word. And it was clear Steph Curry was not the best player in the NBA, which I think scares us all off from saying that anybody is a better player than LeBron. Because even now, if you ask me, I guess I'm going to wind up saying LeBron. But for the first time I can think of in my life, there's like six or seven may be too many, but we've got a handful of legitimate contenders to be that. One of them, by the way, is Kevin Durant. In theory, it shouldn't even be a question at this point. Kevin Durant in 2014, he may not have been the best player in the NBA, but that year he won the MVP. Nobody played better than him. There's no argument that LeBron or anybody else played better than him. 6 years later, Kevin Durant, every bit as good as we thought he could be. We don't know.
That's a great observation that maybe what happened with Steph getting crowned briefly and having the crown rescinded made us a little gun shy. It's a little bit like with boxing where you can't just edge out the champ. You've got to really decisively beat the champ in order to claim that crown. And I guess we collectively have decided that Kevin Durant hasn't, but I think there's something else going on, which is that we don't want him to be it because he wants it so badly and we can sense it. We can sense that he wants our validation. And because of that, because of the way human beings work, if we know you need our love, we're not going to give you our love. And if you're Klay Thompson and you're completely oblivious to our love and maybe just completely oblivious to us existing, then we will give it to you. And I think that's another dynamic. It's personality fueled in a way as opposed to just basketball analysis.
Would we like him more if he was like an actual jerk? Because that's not what Durant is, right? Like he's a bit defensive about some things, but like he's not that guy. So like Jordan wants it really, really bad. And so he goes out and takes it, right? Kevin Durant does what he's supposed to do. And it's like, yo, I'm right here. Like what are we supposed to do? Like, if he were worse about it, it fit, I think, maybe a more familiar archetype, maybe we could give it to him.
I think there's something to that, where there's just something to the alchemy of the personality and how it's projected that if he were worse, if he was kind of a Barry Bonds level jerk, then for whatever reason, it would just seem like he had a kind of just dominance to him and a viciousness, a competitive viciousness that's Jordan-esque in a way. But instead, we can see the vulnerability and we can see that the drive to succeed isn't necessarily about dominating and rubbing people's faces into the ground like Michael Jordan seemed to be motivated by. It's by wanting our love. We can clearly see it. And there's this other dynamic too where in my book, I talked to a lot of people about Kevin Durant. I think some people might think that I'm out to crush him or whatever, but nobody I talked to would ever say he's a bad guy. Nobody ever said that. he would put them through just crazy drama, circumstances where you would think a lot of teammates would turn on you and start airing dirty laundry and everything else. But they always sensed that vulnerability in him and still wanted to protect him after all of that. They didn't think he was a bad guy, even if he was acting in ways that weren't completely nice to them.
I feel like a lot of us just wind up with Durant, and this has been kind of a running thing for me when I've talked about him. Just like, dude, why are you like this?
Yes.
Like, it doesn't, I think it doesn't make sense. And not even, it, I think that we collectively understand how Kevin could be like this, right? Like, I think that, you know, the things that we put together, they make sense. But I also feel like most of us, at least for me, man, if I was that good at basketball, ain't no way in the world I'd be out here arguing with nobody on the internet. And I say this as a arguer on the internet.
Yeah. Well, we all do less of that than we used to, but he seems to be going the other direction. You know, I feel like when I was younger, I was arguing on the internet all the time, and somehow it seems to be ramping up, and it might be unfair, and maybe it's true to who he is that he wants to be this way, or that he's not the happiest guy in the world all the time. But that's not what we want out of this whole sports thing. You know, you're selling us a dream. That's what we want. We want to believe when we're rooting for you and you get on top of that mountain that you're going to be fulfilled and you're going to lead us by example. You're going to be the role model, as much as Charles Barkley didn't want to be one. We're looking for that. That's what we're in the market for. And if you're presenting us an outcome wherein you get the thing and you seem to be just as unhappy and tortured as you ever were, then that's not the story that we want. And that creates a problem.
Yeah, like he's trying to tell us, look, man, I'm just like you. And people are like, yo, I don't like being me.
Yeah, I don't like myself at all.
Like, yeah, like that's his thing. Saying I am just like this person that people don't like, who happens to be themselves. Right? And that's where I wind up feeling bad for him in the scheme of it, is that if I don't know the dude well enough to say that this is what he's doing, right? But if he thinks he's going to find the path through these things, it has got to be demoralizing to feel this way, right? I dedicated my life to this craft. This craft has taken me all these places in the world. The craft has gotten me to all these fantastic places that I'm in. It ain't going the way that I thought it would. And now what do I do? Like, I'm very curious to see what this is going to be like for him in Brooklyn. Because like Kyrie, the thing I always thought was interesting about Kyrie, I totally related to him wanting to leave Cleveland when he did. Cause that was about the time that I was like leaving highly questionable, right? I was like, no, I get where he's coming from. Yeah, you're doing something that is very successful, but you want something that's more your own. Okay, cool. I get it. But the one thing I said at the time was like, I hope you don't think they're going to treat you like LeBron at the next stop, right? like how they treat LeBron is not how everybody treats the number one. That's how they treat LeBron.
Yeah.
And then he got to Boston and it's like, no, you're not LeBron here. Like that's not exactly how we're going to do this.
Yeah. And he's another guy where there's a palpable misery that almost becomes an issue for the league. I thought it was shocking when Adam Silver at the Sloan conference was just openly talking about how miserable the superstars are. I mean, in theory, you're a bit of a PR man as the commissioner and you're selling, I love this game, and you're selling all of that, but he couldn't even hold it anymore. He just had to be open about it. And I do think it almost seeps into what they're trying to promote. And I do think also it is particular to the technology we use these days with social media. And some of these guys, they might not have been the happiest of people, but A, maybe we wouldn't have found out about how unhappy they were. And B, they might have been more happy because it didn't seem like they were living in some kind of panopticon where they were viewed at all times and people were taking shots at them at all times. It's just maybe the wrong personality type lines up with the technology of today and it's creating a particular issue for the NBA. But it seems like KD and Kyrie both exemplify that. And maybe additionally, riffing on your point about Kyrie, maybe he thought that he would be regarded like LeBron because he sells sneakers like LeBron. You know, maybe that was an aspect. I one thing I like about you and your reception of some of the stuff that I've written is that the sneaker thing is just, it's so huge and it's so undercovered. And I felt like it was big in this whole dynamic.
Yeah, that's who they work for, man. These are the people that cut the biggest checks, right? That's who they work for. They play basketball and that then allows them to sell shoes. And the fascinating dynamic of that like 9 month period where Under Armour was a thing because Steph Curry was killing it. And how Kevin Durant, like how all of those things play together. Cause one thing you used to always say that I don't think that people got that was really interesting is that, yo, Steph really wanted to have hot shoes, right? And, like that was a thing. He wanted to be the dude with hot shoes, and his shoes were hot to the people you don't necessarily want your shoes to be hot to if you want people to think your shoes are hot.
Yeah, and that was completely illustrated by the whole Chef Curry debacle in the finals that, hey, if he had gone off for 50 and then won it all, then maybe those shoes just through the force of that somehow become cool. I mean, that's a fascinating question to me, Bomani, is what is objectively good style versus what we've all been deceived by mass marketing and influencers to think is good style? I look at the Flu Game Jordans and I look at that and I go, that kind of looks weird. I feel like if the swoosh wasn't on that, we would say that looks weird. That looks like some red lipstick slathered on some lips and, you know, on a shoe. Like we would react that way. Maybe I'm wrong though, but it's a strange thing where I didn't expect to go here with the podcast, but is there just an aesthetic, objectivity where Nike shoes were just better than Under Armour shoes for a reason I can't even articulate, even though I'm paid to articulate things?
Yeah, no, they got better designs over there. Like, think about this. Like, you say Kyrie sells shoes like LeBron. I could explain why Kyrie would sell shoes like LeBron. Kyrie shoes look better than LeBron shoes do, right?
That sort of toothy pattern that he had it looked good. I can't tell you why it looked good, but it looked good.
Yeah, like consistently Kyrie has better looking shoes. Like, the thing about Jordan was like the ultimate collision, right? The super cool pitch man who's selling the dopest shoes ever made, right? Like the run on Jays really threw like 13. It's just like, yo, they never miss, right? Yeah. Every single one of these is connected, and they're connected in ways that like nobody else had done. There's nobody that's going to be out here selling shoes purely on the strength of his name. I don't think there's anybody that's going to do that.
I mean, with Jordan, it was probably an element of almost like semi-pro where they throw an alley-oop and it just shocks everybody in the crowd because they've never seen such novelty. I mean, some of those choices must have seemed so bold back then to throw some elephant print on a shoe, right? For instance, that must have seemed crazy back then. And now you can't really surprise anybody. And if you're surprising people, you're liable to get mocked on the internet because it looks too crazy and it looks too goofy.
Now, let me ask you some more about with the book. We kind of touched on it a little bit, but the Durant-Curry dynamic is a part that I think that people find to be fascinating because, again, Kevin Durant got there and realized, oh, this will never be your team, right? Like, just so you know, that's not how the breaks go here. It doesn't matter if you're the best player on the team. Like, the Heat, it's interesting because the Heat kind of were LeBron's team, right? But it was still Dwayne Wade's city, franchise, like all of that. Durant didn't get the team part or the city part. And wow, that's got to be kind of whack if you're as good as Kevin Durant is.
Again, in theory, this should have gone exactly like the Miami Heat. If you're looking to the example of LeBron, you know, Dwayne Wade, beloved, drafted by the Miami Heat, but the fans are going to embrace LeBron because he's the better player and all these people hate him. So they must marshal to his defense. They were quite defensive on his behalf. Why it just didn't work out the same way in the Bay Area? I mean, I could come up with some theories, but it just didn't. For one, I think Steph wasn't falling off like Dwayne Wade's game was falling off, and that was part of it. And I think it just additionally, Kevin Durant's just not a star in the way LeBron James is a star for reasons I couldn't even – there's like an alchemy to it. That's what's interesting about it. Just what is it about you that makes you larger than life? Michael Jordan, as we're watching this documentary, he had some like the full package. Everything was lining up and it was creating something that was way bigger than what LeBron is. And Kevin Durant just wasn't even close to the LeBron level in the Bay Area and wasn't superseding Steph. I remember we gave a talk at the Salesforce Tower with The Athletic, and we just did an informal survey and we asked, who's your favorite player on the Warriors, you know, between Steph and KD? It was over 90% Steph, and that was a couple years into the winning of the championships. He just never supplanted him among the fans.
Yeah. And that Warriors fan thing is kind of interesting, right? Because every city's got like a divergent, you know, bunch of people that root for him. But like, I feel like with the Warriors, what you had largely were like black people from Oakland, right? You know, around the arena types that like really, really, really love the Warriors as the hometown team in a very particular way with the team actually being in Oakland. And then a random smattering of Herbs, right? Herbs of all sorts, Herbs of all nationalities. Like, I went to the Warriors Nets game in Brooklyn a couple years ago. And man, it was just so many Herbs in Warriors jerseys. And I'm not saying that Steph Curry is a Herb. I am saying that he plays very well with the Herbs. He is the guy that's like them in a lot of ways, at least to their eyes, right? You know, and you ain't gonna break that bond. It ain't every day a Herb look up in the NBA and be like, that's me, dog. That's what I would be.
Well, it's also a lot of people with kids. I mean, if you want to call kids Herbs, I mean, maybe. I mean, that's part of it. It's that these parents come in, their kids look at Steph and they go, I want to be Steph. I relate to Steph. I like the little guy. He's not very little, but you know.
No, he's not.
On the TV, he seems really little. And for whatever reason, kids aren't looking at gangly Kevin Durant and saying, that's me. I'm going to grow to that height and be that. So that was a big, you know, that was a big factor in it as well. I don't know if Dwayne Wade has that kind of purchase on the kid population. and so, I mean, that is what gave Steph the brief moment of being a thing shoe wise, I think, was the resonance with the kids. But yeah, that's something that KD just could not supplant him. And maybe the question is also, what are you even going for? Why do you even want to? Why are you looking so much for external motivation?
Yeah, I wonder how Steph deep down feels about being the patron saint of Herbs and children. Right? Like, I don't feel like that's, I mean, he'll take it as his base, right? But I feel like there's some, like, he wishes he was some other people's favorite player.
I think he's got a little of that. And I think that you can almost see that he's gotten a little more rebellious, for lack of a better term, over the years, and a little more outspoken and kind of mixing it up with Trump. And there has been the sense of wanting to differentiate himself from the suburban set. And, you know, over the years, the Under Armour dynamic has fallen apart. I mean, it's crazy. There's a before and after as far as Kevin Durant joining the Warriors, and Under Armour stock price being something you would want to hold. It's insane how much that decision tracks with the complete collapse of that company's fortunes. And I think there's always been an element of, does he want to get away from Under Armour? Are things all good at Under Armour? Did he think this was the best decision in retrospect? I think these are all valid questions looking back on it.
Yeah. And I mean, it was the bomb decision for a period of time though. Like that, like there was a time, it was a brief period, but Under Armour had, I don't want to say they didn't have the game on lock, but they had eyeballs in a way that they had never had. It also does not help when the CEO of the company and its biggest endorser kind of have a little back and forth. And it wasn't even really a back and forth as much as Kevin Plank was down with Trump and Steph was like, no, we not. and as I recall, Kevin Plank doesn't have that job anymore, does he?
No. I mean, he has some job that is still within the company, but he doesn't have it. And so the rise and fall of Steph as an MVP candidate, I guess, definitely tracks with his rise and fall as an executive. What was interesting to me about that was when Steph said, no, we don't, Kevin Plank effectively backed down and apologized, which, I mean, that's a theme throughout the book for me, is just the power of the superstar. It's truly incredible and almost unusual in sports for the superstar not just to have the power to get the coach fired. I mean, I think that can happen in a lot of sports, or the power to influence certain decisions or to have executives on pins and needles in the way that Kevin Durant did, but just the power to just crash a multinational stock price. That is very NBA. I think, and I've said it, that Michael Jordan is every bit as important to Nike as Steve Jobs was to Apple. But a lot of the work, the sweat work that he did for Nike was literally sweat work, like out there on the floor. The NBA is just a crazy place.
Dude, like, can you imagine how much it hurt Kevin Plank to his soul to have to apologize after that?
And to take his logo off the shoe. That's something Steph's camp wanted. That's his baby, that UA logo. I might even be wearing it. I'm like, gonna go on a run. And I don't care what logo's on my shirt, but he had to take that off the shoe because it doesn't look good on the side of a shoe. Let's face it. It doesn't really flow like a Nike swoosh does, but I think that hurt him as well, that he had to take orders from Steph Curry, because that's just how important Steph was to his company. Even after Steph made the decision to go along with recruiting KD, which completely kneecapped what Under Armour was trying to do.
So, like, Draymond and his role in all of this, right? Because it's very interesting. He recruits Kevin Durant. By the end, he's as tired as Kevin Durant as everybody else. And I've always found the idea very interesting about Draymond, where he's the sort of cat that dudes may not necessarily want to hang out with, but they love to play basketball with.
Yeah. It is interesting with him, and he became a bit of a scapegoat. You know, some people act as though when he was yelling at Kevin Durant in November at the Clipper game that he drove KD out of town, I like the way he put it, that it was an elephant in the room. I don't think Draymond changed the future by saying there's an elephant over there. I don't think he did at all. I just think that he was saying the thing that everybody knew, but people didn't want to speak up and actually articulate. But he did it in such a way that it kind of went sideways and became a threat to their immediate chances that season. But yeah, I don't think that Kevin Durant's decision had much to do with the way Draymond was treating him. I think the evidence would suggest that Kevin Durant is far more motivated by external messaging than the internal messaging of the locker room. And at a certain point, he had drifted and just become his own entity unto himself, and nobody really knew what was going on with him.
Yeah, he ain't about to call me a in front of my coworkers, though.
Yeah, that was a problem.
There's a line there. Like, I'm going to need an apology for that one, sir. That's just not one that we can let slide.
Yeah. That's why it became a problem. Yeah. I like the Kerr quote in there about how sometimes team chemistry, it's almost like a balloon and maybe it popped right there. I think they did a good job patching the balloon back together, though. They damn near won the championship after all of that under some trying circumstances. But yeah, I do think that that presented a rocky time for their immediate future. But KD was gone no matter what.
Yeah, and I think there's something that's underrated about that team that I think was interesting, is that there are not many runs of basketball that were as successful as this one, where grit on some level was not a defining characteristic. And that wasn't something that people really thought of with the Warriors. Man, I watched Klay Thompson try to shoot those free throws, try to play basketball with a torn ACL as they were dropping like flies to the end, the way they played against Toronto. Like, they were like that heart of a champion stuff that is often very cliche, but there is kind of something too. It's kind of ironic that we got to see it then when there really was no chance.
Yeah, it was there, but it wasn't part of the branding. And we just remember a few things about teams
right
at the top. That's how marketing works. We remember a few things. And, you know, Steve Nash was a great shooter, but passing is his branding. And that's something we're going to talk about a lot when it comes to him. And that was a gritty team in many ways. And they were resilient and they were great at defense, and they ramped it up when they needed to do it. That was real, but they were so defined by fun and three-pointers and offense, and that's what the public liked, that it just wasn't so much part of the discussion. And additionally, we stopped having these discussions because Kevin Durant joining the team kind of ruined these discussions. Let's face it. We can say it made sense, and if you're running the Warriors, you do it 10 times out of 10. But at that point, we weren't really in a position to analyze why it was successful. We all knew why it was successful, because they had the most ridiculous amassing of talent ever. And at that point, can you even really tell anybody, like, oh, this team's actually really gritty, and this team really, you know, minds their P's and Q's on defense when they need to? Nobody cares. Nobody cares. They did ruin basketball to a certain extent.
Dude, it was so crazy to look back on. In 2014, a super team was built. And it was the Cleveland Cavaliers, right? They had LeBron. They went in. They already had Kyrie. They went and made that trade for Kevin Love. They weren't the best team in the NBA for a day, right? Like, even in 2016, I think it's hard to argue that the 73-9 Warriors weren't the best team in the NBA. Like, there's a LeBron thing that happened, you know, to get it over the top. But it's so wild. We did not see this coming to begin with. Like, this team won, I want to say, 52 games in 2014 and won 67 the next year.
Yeah.
With basically the same players?
Yeah. It was almost unprecedented in NBA history that it was unleashed. And I remember Ron Adams, defensive guru, former Warriors assistant coach, said that winning opens yourself up to possibilities. And I think that's also true, where when it starts going, when you start making the climb, then people start realizing that they're capable of more than they knew. And it seemed like a few guys were experiencing that at once. That Klay, the ball movement unlocked his game. Draymond, just by the luck of David Lee getting hurt, gets put in that starting lineup, and suddenly that unlocks his game. I mean, that wasn't any kind of foresight. Steve Kerr did not, you know, take Draymond aside and say, I believe in you. It was just by the luck of the draw that he had that role. And man, there was a lot of luck involved. It just a bunch of things lined up all at once to create something completely new. And they ran the NBA world for about a half decade, save for the whole, I don't know, 2016 finals thing.
Yeah, so what the hell are they gonna do now, man? They gonna be Giannis?
That was funny. I love the internet sleuths, right? Where apparently Steph was saying, you know, I can't even remember the exact diction where he was saying a few months ago at a game, come on, like join me, something like that to Giannis. And afterwards it was reported, I think in an interview with Chris Haynes, that Steph was talking about the gamer tag. He was talking about playing video games. And then just yesterday in an interview with Trevor Noah, he was asked if he's playing video games in quarantine. And he said, man, I haven't picked up the stick since I had my first kid. So God bless the internet for catching that one. It's pretty clear that Giannis is a huge fan of Steph. It's pretty clear that Giannis has a bit of a wandering eye. I mean, it's not like he is saying sweet nothings to the Milwaukee Bucks and that he is forever pledging to be there, but it's all confounded by this whole crazy pandemic situation. And I couldn't even begin to tell you what the hell is going to happen from here. It sure seems like if the Bucks are successful in the immediate short term that Giannis probably won't leave, but who knows? It's all thrown into flux.
Something we haven't talked about nearly enough. Daryl Morey.
Ah.
I'm not saying that anybody's winning from this pandemic. However, it ain't just me. Suddenly became his mantra for everything. Well, it ain't just me.
Couldn't it go the other way, though, where the NBA is now, these owners are so desperate. They're so cash starved. You know, Tillman Fertitta. Yeah, Tillman Fertitta, whose money is, let's see, it's in restaurants, it's in casinos,
and amusement parks. And amusement I looked it up parks. Yesterday.
Yeah.
He has amusement parks.
Woo. It's not too amusing for him, that if China, for the sake of good PR, wants to turn the money spigot on and says the only condition is you fire Daryl Morey, don't you think the owners just go, yep, make it happen, get him out of here, I don't care, free speech, whatever, don't care, bad PR, whatever, we need that $400 million a year, we need it right now, get Daryl out of here. You could also see a situation like that happening.
Yo, man, Fertitta right now, he is in, of all these guys, because all his money is messed up, right? Like, he ain't got no money on the side that he could turn into, like, a silver lining on this situation. He is in all the industries being hit the hardest. Like, what we're going to find out about a lot of these owners is, we're going to find out who's really rich. Because one thing that had happened with owners, really, like, about 15, 20 years ago, is a lot of these people were buying teams with paper money that they didn't actually have. Mm-hmm. We're going to find out who's really got money now. And I don't know what's going to happen to the cap. I don't know what's going to happen to all of these things. But this is a bizarre time for the business of sports.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, commissioners put themselves in this position because they often get these over-leveraged owners in the game because then they have power over them as commissioners. I mean, there's not a lot you can tell a Steve Ballmer if he buys a team versus a guy who owes you an incredible favor because he wasn't even supposed to be able to get this team. I mean, that's how David Stern ran the NBA. And that's all fine and well until a massive global recession hits. I mean, then it creates a few issues. And I wonder with the Warriors, you know, Joe Lacob on paper wasn't a billionaire going into buying the Warriors. He spent a lot of money to get that arena in San Francisco and the last good piece of land in San Francisco. And the idea behind it is, hey, we're going to be a cash cow because not only are we going to have these games, we're going to have concert after concert after concert. I get an email, you know, I get a few emails every week about another canceled concert at Chase Center. You know, oh, no Tame Impala, no Ariana Grande. And I just wonder, what is this doing on the business side of the Warriors? What sort of dynamic is this creating? Because they have to be hemorrhaging.
There's something there that I had forgotten about there, which is arena ownership in concerts, right? Like, I remember, when North Carolina had that bill, it was called the bathroom bill, but you know, that was the thing that was coming around, and the Hornets put out a statement with Michael Jordan's name on it decrying the bill. And of course, we're like, yo, Michael Jordan, you know, he don't come out about anything. Yeah. What happened? And I remember I was at some event not long after that, and I was talking to Fred Whitfield, you know, Mike's man. And Fred was like, yeah, man, you know, this is really kind of affecting the concert business. Mm. You know, Bruce Springsteen said he's not going to play Charlotte. Like, you had those kinds of things. And I was like, oh, that's right. You guys own these arenas. Yeah. So that's another revenue stream that they're not getting. Cause I don't know what's going to happen to the whole concert industry.
Oh man. Oh yeah. I have no idea. And I hadn't even really thought about the implications of that more broadly than how it affects the Warriors.
For a moment, let's act like there was no pandemic, right? Mm. Where would the Warriors be going from here? Like, to me, it's fascinating. I thought, you know, the thing about the Jordan rules is everybody's like, Jerry Krause, how dare you tear this down? But in a world that is a vacuum, I looked at 2019 for the Warriors, and I'm like, yep, this is good as it's ever going to get. You need to start figuring something else out. Of course, nobody's ever going to do that. So they've re-upped on guys who have probably played their best basketball, and they re-upped on them for a lot of money. Where do we go now?
They just need a lot to go right. I need some analogy, some gambling analogy about hitting a bunch of river cards. I don't know. I don't gamble enough to know the analogy, but they need to roll a couple. I sound so like a fake gambler, like in craps. They need to roll a couple of the things, you know, they need a bunch of whatever the snake eyes aren't. That's what they need. Whatever the opposite of the snake eyes are, that's what they need to have go down there. They need to hit on this draft pick. They need to hit on the next draft pick, which should be high value because it's a Wolves draft pick, or they need to package those two picks together to somehow get a great supplemental veteran player. But you know what? Steve Kerr said it. He said it about a couple months ago. He just flat out admitted it and said, we are never going to be that team again. That's never going to happen again. I'm sure Joe Lacob didn't want to hear that kind of talk, but it's probably true.
Well, like, I think about that draft pick, that Wolves draft pick, and I wonder, are we going to wind up looking at that? Remember all those, the mythical Nets draft picks, right? Mm. The Cavs got that Nets draft pick. Minnesota going to mess around and actually get something going. He just went like 37 games, and that's enough to make sure that draft pick ain't good.
Yeah, and we talked so much about the Pelicans trade with the Lakers and what idiots the Lakers were. And yeah, that can bear some serious fruit for the Pelicans down the line. It's going to be a long, long time to see it, but that trade doesn't seem so awful for the Lakers anymore. Sometimes it does pay to be a short-term thinker in the NBA, and the Warriors, to what you're saying, they have a timeline problem. They've got a bunch of guys on the back end of the prime, and by the time whoever they draft gets good enough to provide value, those guys are going to probably be out of the prime. And so how you get everybody on the same timeline, I think that's the issue right now that they need to solve if they're going to contend again. But even if they solve it, they're not going to be the prohibitive favorites. I think that window is closed.
I'm also curious how exactly Steph Curry's going to age, right? Like, we have to remember, he's 11 years deep into the NBA right now, and he's so skilled, but he's also, so much of this is about being so damn quick. And when those margins thin, I'm curious to see how his game is going to evolve.
It's one of the reasons why I'm more open to the idea that they do make a draft pick this season and it's somebody who's on the ball. In this draft where it's a bunch of guards and a bunch of point guards, I know everybody wants a wing, but, and I know they got burned and the D'Angelo Russell experience wasn't the best, but it's why I look at a guy like Killian Hayes out of France who can handle and who can shoot and who can pass, just because you need somebody to carry the torch and maybe shift Steph to more of a role off the ball, because it seems like guys can provide a lot of value off the ball late into their career, you know, as Reggie Miller did. Reggie Miller was still helping his team into his late 30s. And then guys you wouldn't think could stick around in the league for as long, like a JJ Redick, a role player, obviously, just through being that off the ball artist, can stick around. So Steph, I think, can still keep doing that for a long time. The question is, how long do you want him to be the fulcrum of your offense on the ball, taking that punishment? And can you transition to a younger guy sharing that load?
Well, like, this obviously isn't the best use of Steph's talents, but can you imagine how deadly he'd be like playing like a Jason Terry role?
Yeah.
Cause that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? Like a 16 year vet Steph. If Jason Terry could play in the league for 20 years, I think he played 19. Steph Curry at year 17 could come off the bench for a content if he wanted to live that life. He could come off the bench for a contending team and like every now and then give you 20 in the playoffs.
And I don't know why off ball, and Steph is, I think, the best off ball player in the history of the NBA. I don't know why off ball is not more common. It seems like a skill set. You see the guy doing it where he's running around those screens, and it seems like something guys could theoretically do, but there are only so many guys who do it, and the guys who do it are in the league for a long time. So I don't know why it's so rare, but I think that thing is going to allow him to extend his career. But the Warriors need to figure out the other part of it, which is who's bringing up the ball and who's running pick and roll a lot of the time.
I think Steph had to learn how to do it because he came up under a vastly different circumstance than most dudes, which is being the dude at Davidson. Like, I mean, I covered that NCAA tournament. When he did not have the ball, he had to learn how to get away from four, five, six people, right? That's right, six, all six of them. Like, I feel like that game, he had to deal with a different kind of high altitude training to get to that point.
That's a great point that he's been going through the entire team being keyed on him his whole career in that very unusual way that other guys never have to learn. It's why Isaiah Thomas, not Zeke, little Isaiah Thomas, is such an incredible finisher. It's because he's been having to, you know, his entire life try to finish over guys who are taller than he was, because that's everybody. That's probably a big part of it. If I'm the Warriors, maybe I split the difference. Now I'm thinking about their future. I try to get my point guard of the future, my bridge to the future in this draft, and then maybe I trade next year's pick while it still has some allure and get that vet.
I would not have signed Draymond Green to a 5-year contract.
Yeah, but there's some back pay attached to that.
Oh, no, I totally get it. I mean, I understand why they did, right? But this is where the Jerry Krause thing becomes interesting. In a vacuum, like if it's your Madden franchise, you just start it over because there's no sentimentality involved. Different here. But yo, Ethan Strauss, check out his book, The Victory Machine. It's on the Golden State Warriors dynasty. And I will, you know, an anecdote I've shared with Ethan, I'll share with the rest of you, is Andre Iguodala came to the office one day and I saw him and I was like, yo, have you checked out Ethan's book? And he said, nah. And I said, yeah, it was just kind of like how basically y'all did all that winning, but it didn't make anybody happy. And this is before Iguodala signed with the Heat. And he goes, yeah, until you miss it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I wish. You know, there's themes. There's things to check out, not just the nuts and bolts of all of this.
Yes. I wish I had that quote from him before sending the book off, because there is something poetic to that. He's always great for those. But thanks for having me on, Bomani. Anytime. It was a lot of fun.
No, man. All right. Everybody, be sure to check out that book. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple days a week. My man, Gabe Bassane, handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.